CliffCentral.com.
Right, it is time for us to get to our interview of the week. We're trying to get some of the most interesting people we can from all over the world, people who've either written books, because obviously that's a great introduction to people we may not have heard from before, or people who are doing interesting things. And one such person is the amazing L.J. Fenter. L has been covering war zones for all of his life. He is a remarkable human being with some incredible stories. And without giving too much away, I think I must get straight into it, because his new book, which is available, is absolutely riveting. And I breezed through it. I've actually given it to my father to read because he loves reading these war books. It's not really my thing, but my God, once you get in, you don't get out. And it is unbelievable what humans do to each other in a war zone. It's unbelievable what kinds of stories of heroism, stories of cruelty, stories of danger, the level of interaction that someone like Al has at the front line with so many people from all over the world, different language groups, ideological groups, religious groups. He's really been everywhere, and I'll get him to explain it to you in just a moment. But L.J. Fenter has written a number of books. He's written, I think, about 60 of them if you add them all together. And he continues to be prolific well into his 80s. And here he is. He was in studio with me just the other day. We got to have an amazing conversation, and I'm really pleased that we can share it with you this morning. Take a look. Well, I don't think there are a lot of people who could say that they're a war correspondent over the age of 80. I also don't think there are a lot of people who can say that they've been to 50-plus conflict zones and reported and lived.
Well, about 35.
Well, listen, you're... The blurb here says 25 conflict zones and civil wars in Mozambique, Nigeria, Israel, Hezbollah, all kinds of wars in the Congo. Those are still ongoing. In fact, you've just got back from the Congo now.
No, it's Central African Republic.
OCAR.
Which is just as bad. A little worse, maybe.
You said it's... Your exact words were, that's a bad place. And I thought, well, coming from you... There's someone who knows bad places, so I'll take your word for it. L.J. Fenter, it's a great pleasure to have you here.
It's delightful to be here, too.
Thank you, and congrats on the new book. It's called Taka Taka Bom Bom, which you must explain to us in a second. But really, I don't think that there are that many people who can firsthand tell stories like this from so many different places over such a colorful and adventurous life.
Well, there's a reason for that, because I was interviewed by Nigel Farage. Not everybody's cup of tea on...
Right-wing British politician, but
yeah,
an interesting guy.
He created Brexit, and he's on a regular daily program now, Great Britain News.
Correct.
And he got me on board, and he said to me, what in heaven's name possesses anybody to become a war correspondent? And I said to him, well, actually, it's better than working. And it is. That's part of the answer to what I have for you. Because if I can go to a war, I do. The bona fides that you pick up along the way, the people that you end up meeting, they stay with you. And I've outlived many of them. But the point is that if I ask to go to somewhere with Americans or not the British, I'm still a suspect Boer. But almost all the other countries, they say to me, well, what do you want? And when do you want to do it? So, and that's how it works. The same here with Central African Republic. And last year, October, I was in Mali.
Oof. That's not a very stable place either.
And as of today, the British have pulled out, are pulling the forces out. And that's very, very serious, because those jihadist insurgents are, to put it bluntly, damn good.
Well, wasn't there that incident at the hotel?
Well, they have lots of incidents at a time.
Yeah, but recently it made international news because of all the international people who were staying there.
Yes.
And it's always interesting to me which stories are reported on and which are not.
Yeah.
And being a war correspondent is a tough job. I mean, you sometimes find yourself in a place where there's usually a lot going on, but you're there in the week or two that there's nothing. In your case, it seems that the action follows you everywhere.
Well, I don't stick around most times. I go in... I do the job and I get out. That's how I've worked all my life. So I'm not really one for the social scene in terms of getting plastered with the boys after work.
Right.
also, when you get when you become pretty well known, as I am, and I've done quite a few exposures, releases involving nations, Somalia.
You've made the news, some of this.
The Iranian. And for a long while, working for Jane's, doing work for Jane's. I was never employed by them, but I've been doing work for them for 40 years.
You mean Jane's Defense Weekly?
Jane's International Review.
Right.
And they've got 15 other titles. You get known because you are releasing information that is sensitive.
Mm.
And the Iranians came after me after I broke a major story on their links in building the bomb. I said so in 2005. And a lot of Americans, academics, attacked me for being so blatant. And I said, well, you know, Pakistan has got the bomb and North Korea's got the bomb. And those three are joined to the hip.
Mm-hmm. Well, they were Bush's axis of evil, were they not?
That's right. Yeah. And if the one can have the bomb, the others. But the thing is that we're digressing here, but this is important. The thing is that the Iranians don't know what to do. They've got the atom bomb, and Israel's got the thermonuclear, the H-bomb.
Right.
Which is 200 times more explosive.
But Iran, as I understand it, also don't have the delivery mechanism at this point.
They do indeed.
Oh, they do.
And some of it's come from this country.
Hmm. So, wow, that's interesting and controversial.
Well, we're not going to go into that.
Well, I will just start off by prefacing this. I mean, you don't look a day over 65, 70.
Well,
I'm not just being nice to you because we're actually filming this. People can see it for themselves. But you are actually how old?
I'm 84 next week.
Let me tell you something, the kind of vigor that you need, or else just madness. I mean, you might just be mad.
No, it actually doesn't hold anymore because I really am getting old now. I don't have my balance, and I walk with Lynn 2 miles four times a week. She's incredibly fit, a professional diplomat all her life.
That's right. You dedicated the book to Lynn.
That's right. She's Madame l'Ambassadrice, the embassy. Ran the embassy, the British embassy in Gabon with her husband. So we manage pretty well.
I'm very impressed.
But I am starting to fade now.
Okay, so the one ear doesn't work at all.
Doesn't work at all, yeah. I mean, that has its advantages.
Almost feels like I'm interviewing Horatio Nelson here. So no, one ear that doesn't work, we've got a balance issue because of that ear.
Yeah.
But otherwise, I mean, you're still in pretty good nick. I mean, you were.
Well, I'll let you into a secret. There are a couple of things that don't work properly, and we won't go into that.
Al, listen, when I started looking at this book, I first of all thought this is something that my dad will love. He loves reading about the ins and outs of conflict, particularly here in Southern Africa, and it's rich pickings down here. There's still so many stories that are untold. You've told many of them, and it's to your credit that you've also supplied so much information to the world about what has happened, particularly in places like Angola and, you know, old Southwest Africa,
indeed. Yeah,
Zimbabwe, Rhodesia,
yeah,
the conflicts in Mozambique. You could talk about all of those with great authority, where so many people, I think, are removed. And very soon, as always happens with these things, there won't be enough living people who went through these things to be able to speak about them with the kind of firsthand knowledge and sometimes the kind of emotion that really gets it to mean something to others. But when I read some of these stories, and your book, let's be clear about this. You're very clear in the beginning. You say this is not an autobiography.
That's right.
It's rather a collection of stories. But when you tell these stories and you have a real ability to tell them and to make them stick and to almost take up space in someone's head forever with some of them, it must have been difficult for you to choose which ones to include and which not, because you seem to have so many to choose from.
You're right. The epilogue, I state, I'm halfway there. and that's a nice chapter on itself because there's a hell of a lot of stuff.
Mm.
In this business, there's no question that you end up coming into contact with some very unusual people and a lot of information that governments don't know. Like in Nigeria, I got there after the first coup d'etat. I found that in 1964-65, to be one of the nicest countries in the world. It's 5 years after independence. It is a fabulous place, really great. And it was so great that I went to England I got a job that everybody dreams about. I was asked, I was then very well qualified. I studied and qualified in Britain, and I had a string of things behind my name. And Clarkson's, chairman of Clarkson's, Alexander Glenn, asked me, how would you like to run your own shipping line? And I said, in my mind, went to the thought, well, if it was a British guy, he'd say, well, I've never done anything like that before. So I said, when do I start, sir? And what am I allowed? Anyhow, I had 4 months to put the Steena line on the map, in the pool of London where we launched. And then I had to wait for the next project. And I waited so long that I eventually said, I'm not going to hang around. And my managing director said to me, Al, relax, go home and write. You like writing, don't you? I said, yes, I do. Well, it went on for 3 or 4 months. And then I wrote to the Nigerian companies and I got a job. And I arrived in this wonderful country 2 days after the first army mutiny.
Wow.
So there was a situation of it changed overnight, you know, from black to white. Now, when I said to you, you get information, you pick up information, it depends on your own attitude and your mentality approach to what's going on or what's not going on. And in Nigeria, I was sent out into the field because the guy whose job I was going to take didn't want me to take the job. So he thought if he sends me into the field, into the various cities in Nigeria and travel all the time, I'm going to be killed on the roads. Where they're driving
it's like when ancient generals in Rome didn't like someone, they'd put them on the front and hope they wouldn't come back.
So I wandered around and I ended up talking to a lot of people. And I came back to the office in my fourth month and we had a big dinner with the company. And I sat at the table. I said, you know, there's going to be another revolution here. So the managing director turned around to me. He says, Al Venter, you keep to your business and you stick your nose out of politics.
Wow.
From now on. And I said, yes, sir. Anyway, bottom line, the second army mutiny, the return happened shortly thereafter.
As you'd predicted.
And had some of those people in the American and the British embassy got on the road, instead of sitting in their desks, and this is still the case, they would have found out for themselves that what was brewing. And this was a far worse revolution because it was aimed at the Igbo community, and they killed hundreds of thousands.
Well, I mean, the results of those tumultuous years are still being felt in Nigeria to this day. I mean, we still have, you know, very deep tribal divisions. We still have the ongoing problem of Boko Haram in that area too, and obviously their insurgencies, which lead up into places like Mali and even into the Central
African
Republic.
They're all linked with under the mantle of Al-Qaeda. It's very, very well organized. Those guys are good.
And then on the East Coast, obviously, you've also got the
Al-Shabaab.
Al-Shabaab.
Now, Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram are now allied.
Mm-hmm.
And their intelligence systems are so incredible that, boy, I'll tell you, they know what's going on. They know who's arriving at the airports. Right. So I was going to go to Somalia to finish that book, well, actually to finish the one I'm working on now, which is called, it's for a British publisher, and it involves all the jihadist wars that I've covered.
Yes.
And it's a big work, it's almost done. And I thought I'd go to Somalia, but somebody that had just been there said to me, you'd be a little stupid to go because they're going to know that you're on the plane. They check the manifest, they check the passenger lists. Don't.
Really?
And this was somebody at almost diplomatic level with the UN. So I didn't. Similarly, I should be going to northern Mozambique. Well, I've been to northern Mozambique, and I actually went there just before the war started. It is one of the most beautiful places in the world.
Completely lawless, right?
I went to Luweri Game Park, which is like, well, I'm wearing Luweri.
That's right.
And it is really fantastic.
But not a great place to find yourself now, especially if you're a war correspondent talking about stuff that these
So I was warned off
jihadists
by,
don't want you to talk about.
Yeah. The head of the European head of European forces in Mozambique until very recently was a very Limosh Perish brigadier general. And he and I have become great friends because I went into Angola in the north of Angola during the colonial war, and his father was the commander-in-chief of that area. So, I mean, you know, this is how you keep on bumping into people. It's like when I was in Central African Republic in Mali, you know, for the first few days, the youngsters would look at me and say, eventually one of them would come and say, "What are you really doing here?" I said, "Well, you know, this is why, you know." "But yeah, but why aren't you? My grandfather is your age, and he stays at home and watches television." So I said, "Well, if I had to do that, I'm going to be dead in a year's time."
Well, listen, there's certainly no shortage of adventure, and we'll get into some of those. And I also want to go back to Somalia in a moment, but the name, because people are going to ask, "Taka taka bom bom." I mean, it occurred to me straight away that this is the sound of a gun.
Yes, indeed.
And you explain that in the beginning, but just explain especially where, and you tell a beautiful story about your own ancestry and your own history and kind of where the machine gun comes from.
Well, my father, this dates me, fought in the First World War. And the first place he was sent to was Tanganyika, where the South Africans, tens of thousands of
German
them,
Africa.
Were fighting against General von Letter Furbeck. He was actually a colonel, not a general. He became a general later. But he was an incredibly wise general and tactically of the best you can imagine. He was never captured. He was never surrendered. He was the last general to lay down his arms in northern Rhodesia at the end of the war. Anyway, my dad at one stage came under attack because the Germans took the local African population and they trained them and they used them as a fighting force, and they call them askaris. And they were good. They were really good.
That's a word we still use. They used them during the apartheid years here in South Africa.
That's right. Mm. And they invaded Mozambique twice successfully. But he came under attack with what the Swahili word for machine gun is, taka taka bom bom.
Really?
And as a kid, he used to amuse me with that. You know, he'd tuck me into bed at night. I was only a kid of about 3 or 4. And he'd say to me, "Taka taka bom bom, tonight you're going to hear it." You know, and then he'd make the sounds like. And so it went. And it does ring a bell because it's quite emphatic. It tells you, it catches your attention. Let's put it that way.
Oh, absolutely. You don't forget. And it's funny how I'm sure that you can recall all kinds of memories from all the places you've been and the things you've seen. But the ones that stick in your mind are the ones that appeal to more than one sense, right? So if you hear it and you see it,
anybody that says that he's not fearful of being fired at is talking rubbish, because in my case, as I said earlier, I'm the biggest coward in the world. When there's a lot of incoming, I get my head down.
And that's why you're still alive at 84.
Yeah, well, I suppose.
I mean, there are a lot of people that you knew and you were probably quite friendly with who are not around anymore. What about Africa is it that do you think makes this place such a... I mean, it's furious and crazy and mad and dangerous, and the people who live here either by choice or by virtue of birth or maybe by curse of birth in some places, we consider this to be normal. But everywhere else in the world, I mean, this is really the place that you go to.
If
you want adventure in your life, it's the most exciting place on earth.
At the same time, I've been back here now a couple of weeks with Lynn.
Yeah.
And one of the observations she keeps on making, she says, what a happy crowd. There's always a smile. There's always a help. And that is true. That is true of South Africa. You can go just about anywhere.
Mm.
You've only got, you know, the bad guys are maybe 0.05%.
They make a lot of noise.
I know they do, because they're armed. And they are ruthless, and there's a lot of lives being lost. But the rest of the population wants to get on with living. They want to educate their children. And they are managing reasonably well, but I'm afraid for the government.
So let me ask you this, because I know it feels like a reductive question, but I don't want it to be thought of as that. In all the places in Africa that you've been, and I've seen photographs of some of these places, I've read about some of the conflicts, I've read about some of the horrible things that happened, for example, in Rwanda, obviously, during the genocide I've heard reports just recently from the Central African Republic of kind of just how lawless and mad it is. We all know how Somalia was in the 90s and still is in some places.
And yet it was one of the finest, you know, I went there before the war. Fabulous place. The foreign correspondents in Nairobi would make a point of going there because it was
to Mogadishu.
Incredible place. Before the war started, and I'm talking about the 60s and 70s, early 70s, it was a great place to go. It was very Italian. It had been an Italian colony, and it had its own lagoon. And
I looked at an aerial picture. You know this Google Earth, which I'm sure you've also
right,
seen.
Yes.
I looked at Mogadishu on there probably about 4 years ago last because I realized there's nothing to really look at.
Yeah,
I mean, it's more rubble piled upon old rubble upon even older rubble.
Yeah.
And you're telling me that this used to be this extraordinarily cosmopolitan, interesting place.
It had a great big a Roman arch in the middle of the city, a Roman Catholic cathedral. The hotels worked up to a point because it was still a colony. But it was fabulous.
Now? I mean, the last time you were in... Because when I think of awful, awful places that I would feel that I'd really had a bad roll of the dice in life if I were born there, one of them at the top of my list would be Mogadishu.
Yeah, well, you don't go there now. Finished. No. I mentioned...
But you just said you can't go there now.
The Australian government last month issued a notice about traveling, about residents in Somalia, which said, you can look it up on Google. If you are in Somalia at the moment, take the first plane out.
Abandon ship. You're on your own, right? So tell me about the most dangerous place in your opinion, because you really have a breadth of opinion where you can say this and it means something. The worst place that you've been, the most dangerous place you've been, the place that you felt the least comfortable and safe. And I mean, you've got a very high pain threshold compared to ordinary old us.
Yeah, well, that is the, I would rate the Sierra Leone Civil War. I went in there, there was a bunch of mercenaries holding the fort before the British came in. Neil Ellis, the most famous war correspondent, gunship pilot in the world. And I knew Neil from the border war. We watched our children go up together. And I was living in America at the time, and I said, I want to come over. He said, all right, well, tell me when. And he fetched me from the airport in his helicopter. Now, this was an interesting thing because I couldn't fly in directly. I had to fly to Conakry, the neighboring, and then a Russian plane picked me up and brought me to Freetown.
A lot of these places don't have commercial flights going to them.
Well, they still did then. But anyway, The thing is, not some of the countries took a chance. And so he said, go to the control tower. When you get to Freetown, tell them to call Charlie 10, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And they told him, and he landed this gunship right there. Now, when he landed and he's waiting for me to pick up my baggage, he was surrounded by a bunch of British troops because by then the British had moved in under what retired General Sir David Richards, the Chief of Staff of the British Army. An interesting story here.
Yes.
And they crowded around this helicopter, MI-24, and the floor at the back was covered in spent casings, machine gun casings. They had been into a hell of a battle that morning. So they opened the thing, they threw my baggage in, and they took off for the Air Force base. And there I spent almost 2 months with them, and we went flying. And that is where you put your heart in your pocket, because in doing what we had to do, we also came under a hell of a fire. And well, Neil is just so – he's luckier than me. He's never been properly wounded, you know.
He's flying his helicopter around like he's a tour guide into the most dangerous places in the world.
But, you know, the word mercenary he's castigated for that. But the point is that he'd been operating there and keeping the country before the British arrived. So when Brigadier General Richards arrived, he took him under his wing. Because it's Neil that took the SAS on furtive sorties and briefed him of every
Special
operation.
Forces in Rhodesia, huh? Yeah.
Yeah. Neil is actually, he's a very interesting guy. You should meet him.
Well, you know lots of interesting guys. And I'm going to quote from your friend, Frederick Forsyth. He is actually your friend. And you said mercenary just now, which made me think of this because I read it just yesterday. For the mercenary is a simplistic fellow. Not for him the strutting parades of West Point, the medals on the steps of the White House, or perhaps a place in Arlington. He simply says, pay me my wage and I'll kill the bastards for you. And if he dies, they will bury him quickly in the red soil of Africa and we will never know.
And we don't know.
I mean, you know, this is what makes these kinds of stories and these kinds of books, and there are not a lot of them, as amazing as they are, when you were growing up, you couldn't have foreseen any of this. You just spoke about how you were in shipping and all kinds of other interesting things.
Well, as a kid, I was bored to hell with school.
You must have the shortest attention span of anybody. Not anymore. To be able to keep moving.
Not anymore. At that pace. I take it all in. I'm very fortunate with a good, incredible memory. But I do tend to forget where I lost my keys and left them. And Lynn sort of reminds me to do my fly up and things like that.
Well, this book seems to me like it was written with a clarity of mind that very few people can possess in the prime of their lives, let alone in their 80s. And you recall names and places and you explain situations as if, you know, you're still in them.
Yeah, well, I am. And I bring some of it out. I was asked yesterday by somebody whether I suffered from PTSD. And I take that very seriously. But today, unfortunately, PTSD is regarded as a sort of, you know, excuse to stay off work for the day or a week. The real PTSD, and I've only had 10 days of it about 10, 15 years ago. And it's the waking up in the middle of the night in this absolute terror and horror that is inexplicable, and there's no escaping it. So I live in a cottage on a farm in England, in south of England, and I then threw one of the windows open and hung half out the window just to get the air. And at the time, I had a very good friend in America, and it was then 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I phoned her and I said, I've got to talk to you. And I said, listen, I'm having a problem. She said, what is it? And I said, I am so fearful, I can't even explain it. And she talked me through to dawn. And then I got to sleep. And that went on for another 9, 8, 9, 10 days. I can't remember. And then it ended. And I've never had it again. I had it once about a short while ago. And I was going to phone Lynn, but I thought, it's just the once. So I seem to have come through unscathed. A lot of people don't.
Do you think it's a...
I can't explain it.
Well, okay, then we'll end that line of questioning. But, I mean, do you recall what brought it on?
Yeah, it's this is one of the most shocking experiences of my life was a Beirut operation that I went on. I spent a lot of time in Lebanon during the war. I was with Israelis. I've been in with the Israeli Defense Force many times, and I was close to them. I was close to the establishment accepted me, and they let me go through into South Lebanon through a closed border at, I think it's called Rosh HaNikra. And, you know, when the first time I arrived, they said, you get the hell out of here. And I said, no, I can be. So they phoned. Israelis are very good with QCOMs, and they came back and apologized. And after that, I went in on a Hertz hired car. I never told Hertz many times, but anyway, that was...
They should have made you pay a super premium knowing what kind of work you did.
Well, that's that time. But anyway, there was another time. I worked every time I went into the war proper, yeah. I worked with the Christian forces. Mm-hmm. Most of the media worked on the other side of the Green Line with the Muslim forces. Mm. The British were very pro-Muslim, and, mm-hmm. and the Christians were castigated as mercenaries or unbelievers or whatever. Anyway,
it's easier to demonize them.
I ended up spending some good time with these guys, and they looked, well, it's not a case. You can't look after somebody in Beirut because there's a lot of stuff falling on people's heads all the time. And there was one evening that I was with a young guy who was tasked to look after me. His name was Christian, 21 years old. He'd been at the Sorbonne. Mm-hmm. French is the second language, but for the Christians, it's the first almost, Arabic and Christian, and English, French, sorry. And he took me, he said, how'd you like to see the Green Line from right up close? Because it's like in New York City with the tall buildings and only the street separating the two sides, and heavily barricaded, but also very dangerous because infiltration takes place. So I said, okay. He said, okay, we're going
to... I mean, this is almost like being taken to the wall in East and West Berlin in the...
That sort of thing. That sort of thing. Yeah. So I said, all right, we'll go. And we went underground along a very well unlit path where some of their guys had been killed by an assassination squad waiting. And so they were very careful. And they got me to the line. And there was this big building opposite, dead, black, excepting for one little veranda on the first floor, about 30, 40 meters that side. And he said, poke your head out quickly and have a look. He said, that's our target. I said, what do you mean our target? He said, we're going to hit it. He said, you're going to hit it. I said, with what? He said, well, he had their version of an RPG-7, which is quite a sophisticated weapon, and it works the same way, with enormous blasts out the back. And I said, hell, that's kind of you, but do you mind if I take a rain check on this one? I said, wow. I'm not really involved, and I'm not comfortable in this closed confine. So he said, the section leader said, okay, we'll do it. So I had to stand well clear. Him and I, Christian and I, stood well clear, and he blasted, and it was a very simple thing. The rocket went into this concrete veranda, and there were five or six Syrian troops, and I believe they were all killed. Anyway, we then made our way. We went back to our side, and there was a little restaurant there facing the opposite side of the wall, and we had supper with hummus and tahina and pita bread and so on. And then he took me to Sodico, which is an unfinished super 24-story building. And we couldn't go up in the lift because it was unfinished. So with the last six or seven stories, we had to
use the stairs,
climb normal stairs. And we got to the top, and there was Beirut lying on all sides. And it was a spectacular, shady view because most of the lights were out on both sides for obvious reasons. But Christian by then was acting a bit strange. He was a little bit on edge. And it was him, me, the commander, and one other guy, four of us up there. And it was a shell, unfinished shell, right up to him. And suddenly, the front opened up. It must have been 10 or 15 kilometers opened up on the Syrian side against in Beirut. Well, this is something that I've never, ever seen before. Because I'm sitting up there, and for some time, you know, the rockets and missiles and mortars and everything was exploding all, you know, but not too close. And then somebody started using a ZSU-23-24, four-barreled heavy machine gun, big job. And it fires 2,000 rounds a minute, but you pull the trigger for perhaps a second, and then you get a ball of fire about 50 meters across, maybe, I can't, who knows at that speed, maybe 100 meters, but it is a ball of fire, and it doesn't sound like a machine gun, it sounds like a roar of a motor. And the first salvo went to our left, and the second salvo went to our right. Now, had the guy aimed just 1 degree, I mean, there's no possibility.
But did you think at that point they were actually trying to go for what was in the middle?
They were avoiding us. And then we had a tremendous blast below us from not that lot. And there was a scream where Christian had stepped back into an empty lift shaft.
Oh, Jesus, and he fell down it.
And we knew, and they got on the radio, and they said, get down. Now, the commander of that unit, whose name is Rocky, I got to know Rocky very well, a tough, really tough Christian Lebanese guy, and we met him halfway down. And there's a hell of an argument between him and the commander that was looking after, and they're furious row. And I had to pass Rocky. He let me go first, and then the commander said to me afterwards, he said, he was coming to throw you over. He thought you'd killed Christian. And I had to explain to him that you were lying right next to me. And that is the sort of situation you get yourself into. Now, that caused me, and it still does, because I was there when they pulled his body out from below, and his knees touched the back of his head. And then at 4 o'clock, maybe 5, I heard bells ring outside. And they'd called his parents in the meantime, and they buried him there and then in the morning. And so that was something that I can't get out. I was in a terrible state. We went right down to the basement. It was a very big basement down below. And then they'd worked out where it had come from. And they were dropping 240-millimeter mortar shells on us, and the whole building shook, you know, every time one of these things, and the dust came down from the roof. And I was in such a state that by morning, the commander came to me and said, sat on the edge of the bed. He said, "Al, pull yourself together." He said, "You're not. This is not you to do. To this is what happens in war, you know." And I said, "Yes, but had I not been here, it wouldn't have happened." And that's true.
With all of your experience now in these situations, do you think that war changes people forever, and how does it change them? Because what that commander said to you is probably true. He knew what he was talking about, and he'd seen you, you know, in a more composed state, let's say.
Yeah, yeah.
With what you've seen and what you've witnessed firsthand in war, how does it change people, and what does it do to them? For those of us who've never been in a conflict zone.
Most of the guys that I have been, and I'm going back now, I'm going back 60 years. Most of the guys that are really involved in the heart of it, special forces, secret police, people that ended up killing somebody, I don't know many of them that have not been so severely affected that they either... So many of them ended up in car accidents, abnormal number, and probably because they were drinking themselves to death. Killing people is easy enough. You can probably get away with it, but doing it more and more. British SAS, I've got a lot of British SAS friends, and they're fine guys. They are chosen because of their qualities, but they don't seem to survive very long afterwards. An interesting story here is that I went to America after I'd got out of Mali last year, and I met a guy that I was with some American Special Forces, and they were having a little powwow in on the West Coast. And Floyd said to me, he said, "I'm going to introduce you to the guy that had you under protective observation for 3 years. He headed the team." I had no idea that I'd been under protective observation in Canada for 3 years. And I met him, and it was quite emotional. His name was Eric. And he said, "I know you, Al Venter, better than you know yourself." Now, I then said to him, now suddenly a guy, this is thrown at me, and I had no idea. I knew that they were watching me in long-distance roads because there was always be a car about a mile or two behind. That I was aware. And that pleased me, because that's good. That's good news. But I then said to him, "Well, 3 years, I mean, how big is your team?" He said, "Three-man team." Wow. Can you imagine how much that cost?
You're important.
No, it's not a case of important.
But I'm saying, I don't think there's any celebrity that's had a three-man team following them for 3 years.
I'm under serious threat. And I said to him, course. I said to him, "Eric, how, what was the threat variable?" He said, "Well, I can't talk about it."
Mm.
But I know who it was. I know which country it was that was trying to get to me. So, and I'd imagine, having lived in America in the same sort of period, the Americans also kept a good watch on me, because I did a bit of gun running by accident from Canada into Detroit. And the guy said to me, "When you arrive at the border, have you got any weapons?" Now, I'd been living in America for about 8 or 10 years, and I thought, you know, I'm home. But I had never formally declared myself. I'd overstayed my welcome.
Mm-hmm.
I said, "Yes, I've got a shotgun and a handgun," which should be handed to me by a very good friend who said, "You've written that book about Iran," and he said, "You better have these." And I said, "I don't need them." He said, "Take them."
Wow.
So I then had come out of Canada into America, and he said, "Have you got anything to declare?" I said, "Yes, I've got a handgun and a shotgun." He said, "I suggest you drive up there." And when I got to the top, another guy said, "Get out," and I was made to assume the position. He went over me very quite brutally. And then I was put in a room. And I then said, "I suggest you phone your boss in Washington." And they did. And 2 hours later, the first time in my life that I've ever had all the members of a border unit come out and wave me goodbye. He wouldn't let me into America. He said, "You've got to go back to Canada." I said, "Yep, but I'm... You know, I'm here."
I'm sorry.
"You just committed a federal offense. I can't, in front of my staff, let you come through. So you go back to Canada, you go into somewhere else."
But just the idea that you could use the line, I suggest you talk to your boss in Washington. It's something that I think most people dream that one day they can say something like
okay,
that
well,
and get away with
it's,
something.
It's an open fact that I did a job for the CIA.
Mm.
And that is a story in itself in Afghanistan. I got the crew together, and they paid me a hell of a lot of money. Well, we won't go on.
Well, how much can you even say about some of these things? Because this also occurred to me during the writing of this book. You were a person who had access to information which could have sunk governments in very many situations. You could have done an enormous amount of good or bad in a conflict zone. And there's probably some stuff that you're not allowed.
There's a hell of a lot of stuff
to say. And there's some stuff that even when you're dead one day, we won't know.
Yeah, well, you know, we'll just leave it at that.
So out of all these mad, bad, and dangerous-to-know people that you've encountered over the years, who are the ones who stick out the most, and who are the ones who've stayed around the longest? Because you do have some pretty well-known friends who've written some amazing books. I don't doubt for a second that, and you don't have to confirm or deny this, but that some of the inspiration for some of their stories have come from things that you've told them. And from people that you've introduced them to, or just explained
along
your travels. Frederick Forsyth, John Le Carré. These are both people who've written the outside of the book,
the blurb.
Blurb. Yeah, both of them have given you high praise here. Freddie
was CIA. He was MI6 from very young.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know it because Freddie spent time with me in America. And as he says in his letter, which I reproduced, he says, "You and I are both lucky to be alive. We've made it. And at your next time you go to the pub, raise your arm and have a pint with me." And I didn't know how he knew that. And now I know that he hadn't come out yet as being Secret Intelligence Service.
How does that even happen? Do you just get a call one day? Does someone pitch up at your house?
No. Freddie is a very clever man.
No, I don't mean him. I'm talking about with you with the CIA job too. I mean, does someone just call you up?
No, I can't. I'm not going to go into that.
Well, I'm not interested in who or where, but do they arrive in person or?
No, I got a call from somebody saying I was in Cape Town, living in Cape Town. Mm-hmm. I'd made a lot of money, by the way, in my work. I was one
You've
of
written
the,
lots of books.
Yeah, but they don't make the money, so we won't go into that detail either. But
what a shadowy man you are! All right, go on.
So I got a call saying, can you come to Washington? So I was in America at the time. That's right. And I was in England at the time. So they sent me a ticket. And in Washington, I was greeted by two guys. And they said that we'd like you to consider doing a job for us. And I never, the word CIA never came into it.
Right.
So they then said, what do you want? We need an hour-long documentary made on the war in Afghanistan. The Russians were then, 1985, were in control. We want to celebrate this fifth anniversary. And I'm delighted. You know, I mean, you don't get an offer of a job like that. So they said, how much do you want? So I said, $250,000. So they said, all right. I said, and also, I only travel first class. So they said, no, well, that's not on. That's not on. Sorry. So I said, listen, you've asked me to do this job. You've obviously looked over my circumstances. I travel first class. Well, of course I didn't. I said, so the two went into hubba hubba there in the corner, and they came back and said, all right, well, this is a special thing, so we'll accept that you travel first class. And now.
Well, that'll only get you so far, because once you're in Afghanistan, there's no first class.
No, well, this is the cruise. This is the cruise. I had three crews in there at one stage.
Okay.
And I also had crews in Africa working at the time.
Afghanistan fascinates me. I mean, what an interesting place. And obviously, it's been in the news virtually nonstop since that Russia-US.
And it's never going to come right because it's just a total catastrophe. It's a very sad situation. But that is in the second volume that's following.
Okay, so we'll get to that. Yeah, because I think it's a great travesty that I couldn't get to read any of that in this one. So let's just talk about Africa again, because there can't be very many places that you still want to go to that you haven't seen. And there can't be very many people. I mean, Idi Amin features in this book, for heaven's sake.
Yeah,
Idi Amin. I mean, this is someone who...
I took my then wife into Uganda, and we were under surveillance. I was terrified. I was really terrified because they kept us under surveillance. And I took her up to Murchison, the falls, and I stayed in a tented camp. And I didn't sleep at all because I was aware that they were watching us. And they didn't do anything. But three journalists had been murdered by then. There was a pair of Scandinavians.
I remember that. And, I remember reading about it because didn't.
But they did silly things. You know, there's a way that you end up being able to assess situations. I'm very conscious of really not taking chances. There are things that you don't do, and that's one of the things. So I went there often, but I never traveled on a normal flight because you had the goons waiting for you at the airport. I would either come in by boat.
What would they do, shake you down, take you away, and interrogate you?
No. You just know they're there.
Oh, okay. So you just don't want to take the chance. So when you say you don't take regular flight, you charter your own flight in?
I will find out who's got a charter flight going in, or okay. I'd go by the boat that goes around Lake Victoria. Wonderful trip itself.
Because you can hop on anywhere and hop
That's
off
right,
everywhere.
Sure. And then I'd only stay long enough to do my job and get the hell out of there. And I'd go out on the road to Kenya, but I wouldn't cross at the border. I'd get somebody to drive me a couple of miles up and cross the border, then come back to the road and then get another vehicle. So there's ways of doing it, but you can't always avoid because you've got to stay in a hotel.
And they take down your details there.
You're on file, you know. Mm. It's there. And I spent a lot of time.
Did you ever get paranoid about things, especially once,
you know? You can't if you're not in this job. You have to just assess. And I went into Lebanon 3 years ago. I wanted to go back to the Israeli border. And I think I mentioned this elsewhere, that I had to... very complicated business to get authority, military and government, to go to the south because it's Hezbollah country.
Mm.
And I had to hire a car with an Arab driver, and he took me down to Nakura, which is the United Nations base. But on the way there, in a place called Tyre.
Tyre, the famous ancient port of Tyre, on the Mediterranean.
We were stopped, and Arabic spoken, and then the guy turned, he got in. And he turned his head, he went off, and he said, why are you here, Mr. Fenta? I said, well, you've asked the question knowing my name. You know very well why I'm here. Do you have authority to be here? I said, that's another stupid question. I said to him in that language, that's another stupid question because you know bloody well I couldn't have got through the roadblocks without the documentation.
Right.
And then I was dropped. Then he got out. Then I was dropped at the base at Nakura, and all they would let me sleep in was a big hotel across the road from the night. And I expect to sleep inside big walls.
Yeah.
I don't sleep if I haven't got big walls around me and somebody at the door. And you ask me, is there ever a circumstance where I cut loose? Well, I didn't sleep that night, and I then got a taxi, took me back to Beirut, and I got on the next flight to Europe. So... yes, there are times when you get the hell out of there. You don't have an option. And that's one of them. Now, I knew Hezbollah quite well because I had previously interviewed Hezbollah. I'd been in Beirut. This is the same time that Princess Di, the same month that Princess Di died.
So September 1997.
Yeah, so I made contact with a Shiite. I asked, and I said, I want to visit your commander,
mm-hmm.
Hezbollah. He looks at me and he looks to the sky. I said, $100. He said, okay, I'll see. So I waited days and days, and eventually I phoned up the British Embassy, and I said to him, he knew me because I was writing for Jane's, and I did a report for Jane's, And I said, look, I'm trying to get to Hezbollah. He says, well, Colonel, I can't remember his name. And he said, why the hell do you want to speak to those
bastards?
Exactly. And he said, leave them alone. You know, just get out. You know, don't do that. So anyway, within an hour of that telephone call, a car arrived downstairs and took me to meet the fellow. I can't remember his name. It's quite a complicated.
I'm fairly sure he's dead by now.
No, he's not actually.
Not?
Because I was thinking of meeting. I was thinking of contacting him when I was in Nakura last time. And so he invited me in. A very charming gentleman, spoke perfect English. Now, week before, I'd been with the Israeli forces along the border, and the Israelis were still occupying part of South Lebanon and taking quite bad losses. And I'd been in on patrol with them, and we talked and we exchanged ideas. And he then said to me, by the way, how did you enjoy your trip in Israel?
Oh, he knew all the time.
So I said, you obviously know that I was there, that I have two passports. And he said, how did you find them? I said, well, things are not good, you know, to be quite honest with you. There's a lot of problems with the number of deaths and so on. He said, well, how long do you think you'll stay? I said, not long. He said, really? I said, maybe a year. I was out by 2 days.
Sure.
That's a guess. That's a guesstimate. And anyway, as a result of that, I've never been able to cover the war in Israel, cover the border with Israel again.
Yeah, on
the way home, I took the train. I was living in America. I took into JFK. I had a steel briefcase. And for once, I took the bus into town instead of getting a cab. And I got off at Times Square, or where they dropped us, and I put my thing down, and I did something here, and it was gone.
You're joking.
Yeah.
It was taken away, huh? They were watching you the whole time. You see, this would make me paranoid.
They were very, yeah, but this is in America now.
So but they know everything.
They knew I'd been with those forces, and I lost all my photographs. So that was the biggest loss of all. And I was willing to pay $1,000 to get it back. So I went back the next day, and somebody said, yeah, I met a guy there who was hanging around. He said, I know who took your case. I said, well, I've got $1,000 for you. Get it back for me, extra $1,000. He said, don't play with this one.
Oof.
He said, just forget it. Don't play with it.
Oh, my God.
And I did. I had no option. The funny thing is that I took my return ticket and my passport out of my suitcase while I was still on the bus. Sort of a, you know.
Precautionary thing.
Yeah.
So you're not paranoid, but you're always prepared.
Well, you do silly things, you know.
But, you know, you took the bus, so it wasn't your normal course of action.
And I didn't normally take the bus. And it didn't need to take the bus because it's a short flight from London. Or where, I can't remember. Where.
Well, from JFK into town is what, like an hour in the car?
Yeah.
You probably find ordinary travel quite boring.
Incredibly so. Believe me.
You find yourself getting on a commercial flight and becoming very, very bored with all the lines and the ordinary stuff and the people with their, they can't find their tickets. And meanwhile, used to rushing out of a place in a war zone.
Normally I travel one step up premier economy, but this time I left it too late and I've had to travel. And Tafelberg were very good. They got me a window seat. So.
Okay.
And that's...
Well,
11 hours.
Well, all of this adventure has luckily for me brought you to sit in front of me and tell you for you to tell us just a little bit of the incredible life and the incredible stories that you still have.
Quite a good introspection to the whole scene, it seems.
I'm thrilled to have you here. Thank you so much for your time. And it's really a great pleasure and privilege to be able to just sit opposite someone who's seeped in so much of this best and worst of human nature. LJ Fenter, it's Tucker Tucker Boom Boom. People must buy it, read it. Don't take my word for it. You can listen to him for just 2 seconds of this interview and you'll see why you have to read the rest. So good to have you here. Thank you again.
Thank you, Cliff. Good. CliffCentral.com.